Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Thursday, the 23rd of June, we're going to talk about science and the stars. If you listen to our show regularly, you know that both Rhonda and I love talking about these issues. We had a great show on the moon landing on Monday, was it? The week's gone by, Monday. And today we're going to talk about all kinds of different issues. Ellen Pesch is our guest. Ellen is director of the Barlow Planetarium, which I think is kind of it's not undiscovered necessarily, but not enough people know about this wonderful resource in this part of the state. He has spent 20 of the past 21 years working in planetariums. He's worked at the Louisiana Arts and Science Center, at the Saunders Planetarium, at the Museum of Science and Industry in Tampa, Florida, and for a year now at the Barlow Planetarium at UW Fox Valley. It's a wonderful facility. He was so gracious, and we want to thank him publicly for giving us a private showing last night of a Bad Astronomy, the show that's there now, and they did this light show for us and put us on a roller coaster and did a laser show. It was just a really, really nice thing. Ellen, thank you. And they served us. It's true that food gets to everybody. They even served us popcorn, which was so nice, and it was good popcorn. And so we're just really happy to have him with us to talk about all that's going on with space. And I learned a lot about what happened in this country in the 60s as we celebrate the 40th anniversary of the moonwalk on Monday of this week. He was telling us that this is the first major planetarium in the state of Wisconsin, but a lot of money was available from Sputnik funding back in the 60s, and that's why we have that here, which I certainly never knew. He is so enthusiastic about so many issues that I'm sure you're going to have a rip-roaring good time with him. There's our microphone if you want to talk. If you want to join us by phone, the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Hello, Ellen.
Good morning.
Yeah, you were such a gracious host. We had a lovely time. And you told us as we were leaving that we were to look in the sky, and we missed it last night because it was a little cloudy. What was in there, the sky, last night?
Well, the space station is always up in the sky. We've had people on the space station since October of the year 2000. But right now we have Endeavour and the space station attached, and it's going around the world every 90 minutes, and it's been making passes over Fox Valley. And there's 13 people on that structure right now, which is just amazing.
Is that something? How many? I didn't know that. Did you know that? All these people are up there. So we were looking in the sky for it last night. Tell me about, because it is the week that we think about the moon particularly, the funding that came for places like Barlow from the Sputnik, from the space race back in the 60s. Is that why you're where you are, because of the space race? They gave you the planetarium?
Well, the Barlow has been around since 97. And we're open in the spring of 98. However, there was a planetarium that was at UW Fox Valley before that. You can still see the structure if you come up to the Barlow Planetarium. It's just this little dome, a little bit ways from the Barlow Dome. And that was the original planetarium at Fox Valley. And a lot of school kids around this area visited that planetarium as kids. It's a math lab now, but due to the work from the 60s and 70s and 80s in that small facility allows Fox Valley to open the first major planetarium in the state of Wisconsin in 1998. So it all connects back to that little satellite that was about the size of a beach ball back in 1957 that got everybody looking up at the sky.
Right. No, that's interesting. It was interesting to me that most of us when we were kids, I'm sure you sort of sat out in the backyard and you just go off into this another world looking at the sky and thinking about what's out there, et cetera. It's really quite something. The show that you have on now on Bad Astronomy, it seems to me as though it is such a mystery to us that it's understandable why people believe in astrology, why people maybe had questions about how we could possibly land somebody on the moon, so they believe these bizarre theories that we never went there, et cetera. They're very misguided. But in a way, you look at it and you say, God, it's so enormous, it's so unfathomable, that you can almost understand people trying to make that kind of sense of it by reading the stars or whatever, right?
Well, our brains are so complex. And our brains are capable of seeing patterns where there aren't patterns sometimes. And that's what happens. And science is a great way of looking at that, asking the questions, going through the scientific method, where a lot of the things, if people would just ask a couple more questions, the truth can come out. And even as we talked about political science last hour, there's hot button issues and people will say something. Now, it may not be completely accurate, but it gets everybody riled up. Well, the same thing in science. If you say something, whether it's a theory of gravity or the theory of the origins of the universe, all that stuff, we're finding more and more information that supports those theories. And even the definition of a theory is much more than a guess. Theory, when you get to a theory, everything is pointing in that direction. Mm. And gravity is a theory. And you know what? That doesn't tell me if you don't want to believe in the theory that you should go out and jump off the bridge because you're not quite. However, I mean, the Hubble right. Space Telescope, what we're doing now in the Hubble, and just it's coming up on 20 years that it's been up there, has rewritten the books. There's stuff that even in popular culture that is said now that is now incorrect. Thanks to the Hubble Space Telescope, science moved on.
Yeah, those pictures have been such a gift to us, haven't they?
They have.
Just been knockout beautiful.
And it's one of the reasons that we got this servicing mission that just came back, is the new telescope that will replace the Hubble Space Telescope won't return the pretty pictures. It's going to do great science. It's going to do cutting-edge science. We'll see deeper than the Hubble can see. But the Hubble is able to take images in the visual part of the spectrum that we can appreciate. Mm-hmm. Our eyes don't appreciate the ultraviolet and the infrared as much, but boy, the pictures of the pillars of creation or the Jupiter pictures and Saturn pictures, all those really get people excited. And even NASA said it was a great public affairs tool. The science was great, but boy, people could really get excited about this school bus-sized telescope that's going around the world at 360 miles above us.
Right, exactly. So were you one of those kids who looked outside and you just kept looking outside?
I'm originally from Western Wisconsin. So you know what? When I think back to my childhood, the stars were always there. It wasn't something I ever missed. I mean, I still remember in my earliest childhood looking out of our driveway and seeing the Big Dipper hanging above our neighbor's garage. That was the position of the Big Dipper.
Right.
And the Big Dipper sticks out nicely. And it's those, where were you when you remembered this stuff? And that sort of thing. I don't remember the moon landing. I was about 4.5 years old when the original moon landing. I remember some of the later ones thinking that they were going to actually splash down in the Black River, which was the big body of water near us. So I was at our bay window watching for this capsule to come down. And it's that excitement of seeing the later missions, the shuttle missions, being in high school when the shuttle first launched. Because in the middle of my school career, there was no space program.
Mm-hmm.
Apollo stopped, mm-hmm. and then we were waiting. Skylab was up, and Skylab fell because the shuttle didn't get up in time. And then the shuttle, and now we're coming up. I mean, we're in the swan song of the space shuttle. I mean, mm-hmm. by next September, there will be no more shuttle missions.
Mm. One thing that was striking to me was this incredible amount of work in minds. It was, we were doing this show, the Rocket Men book is really a good book. The author was on earlier, and you would love it, knowing your enthusiasm for all of this. 400,000 people it took to have us be able to go to the moon, which is an incredible number of people. And he also talked about all the things we got as a result of that, all the technology we got, what we learned about some diseases, we got cell phones, we got Blackberries, we got all of that. It seems to me as though, A, my husband and I have arguments with, we argue about a lot of things in a good fashion. I mean, it's good. We keep each other's minds going. But we argue about whether some of this is worth it, you know, or if we have too much famine and hunger, et cetera, on Earth. And I just keep thinking, you know, it's just in us. We just have to go and see all of this. But I don't think NASA has done a good enough job selling themselves so that we can do more of it. To know, here's what we got as a result of going to the moon. It's a substantial amount.
I think the philosophy and the mentality is still there, but not at the level it was in the 1960s,
right.
Where you had a young president that was – he made his speech sending us to the moon 3 weeks after Alan Shepard made a 20-minute flight into space. That 20-minute flight was characterized by Nikita Khrushchev as a flea jump. And it really was. Going to do what Alan Shepard did to going to then next step is Earth orbit, that is a big leap. And to have a president stand in front of a country and say, after a 20-minute mission, to basically tell the country, we're doing an 8-day mission to the moon where we're going to send people a quarter of a million miles away.
Yeah, of course.
No life. I mean, if something goes wrong, bad things happen. And we even look at, of course, the popular movie Apollo 13. People who lived during that time, who remember that and watched it and were old enough to understand, a lot of stuff wasn't coming out about Apollo 13. Only later did we realize that they were probably an hour, maybe a few hours away from death. But you had this group of people working together, and as one of the NASA people said, this was our best hour. Because we took a problem and solved it with materials on board. And it's amazing that we can pull that sort of stuff and do that. Now, I think we're heading back closer to that direction. We have a time frame of shuttle stops flying next fall. We have about 5 years before we launch the next humans from America in an American space vehicle. The space station will be serviced by the Russia from Kazakhstan at Star City. And then we're back in space. 5 years later, we're back on the moon by 2020. And by 2025, the plan is to hopefully be on Mars, which is what we should have done in the 60s, but we were in a space race.
Right.
We want to get to the moon. Getting to the moon fast wasn't necessarily the best way to stay in space for now we're at two generations.
And when you are asked the question, why should we go to Mars, you answer?
I think, first of all, I do think it's in our makeup. We get to one mountain, we look and see what's over that horizon and see where, what, I mean, my daughter's six and does that. She pushes the limits, and then when she sees, she wants to go further. I think it's in us. I mean, our country was based on a bunch of people who left Europe. Now, if they would have fixed everything in Europe in the 15th century before they start coming here, then, and what if they would have stopped at that point? Because we have resources here, and we're having this discussion around earlier today. There's resources on the moon that we can use. There's resources on Mars. Understanding stuff off of Earth allows us to understand Earth better.
Right.
I mean, we're talking about global warming on Earth right now. Well, you go one orbit in from Earth, you have Venus. Venus has perfected global warming. It's 900 degrees. It's carbon dioxide, the gas. I mean, so it just keeps building up, and now we've reached on Venus a nice equal temperature of about 900 degrees day or night.
Ooh.
It's a car parked in the sun with the windows rolled up all the time. So now we understand that warming gases like CO2 have that effect. Now we can start saying, well, you know, is something happening on Earth? Is it going up? Is it not going up? So we get to study that. Looking out allows us to look in and understand better.
Yeah. I love the part of the show where you took us, you allowed us, because I didn't know you could do where our next galaxy is. You look in the sky. You got to go to the show, everybody, because you can find out, first of all, just for summer sky watching, which is wonderful right now, because we're going to lakes and places where you can see the sky. But there is a place in the sky where you have to look at another star to see where the next galaxy is.
I mean,
it's so neat.
Well, and your eye is actually capable, under a nice dark condition, is capable of seeing a candle from a mile away. However, in today's electronic society, where there's lights everywhere, our eyes never reach that adjustment. But there is this little smudge in the sky off the constellation of Andromeda. It's called the Andromeda Galaxy. It has a big history for us because it was a galaxy that Edwin Hubble looked at to start understanding galaxies and measuring that things were moving away from us. And this galaxy is, in astronomical terms, 2.2 million light years away, which basically puts it at 13 million trillion miles. And you can see that with just your eye. Now, we played a little trick. Under a perfectly dark sky, you don't even have to play a trick. Your eyes are designed to see color, but if you don't look at something directly, it actually hits a more sensitive part of your eye. And that's why I asked you to look a little bit away, and suddenly this galaxy turns on. With school kids, I'll have the boys look at it and the girls not look at it, so they don't think I'm touching a button and just turning it on and making it appear for them. But you can see this 300 billion stars in the sky. That's our home galaxy. That the light that you see from that galaxy left that galaxy 2.2 million years ago.
Isn't that stuff just... Just incredible. It's hard to think about it.
It's a great thing about looking into the nighttime sky, because you're literally looking back in time no matter when you look. Even the moon is seconds away. The sun is 8 minutes away. If somebody turned out the sun right now, it'd take 8 minutes for the light to stop coming to us.
Hmm.
It's that far away. This galaxy, the amazing thing about this galaxy, it's 120,000 light years across, we estimate about. You don't even see the front of the galaxy and the back of the galaxy in the same time frame. You see the front of the galaxy 120,000 years before you see the back of it. So if you had twins born in the galaxy on opposite sides of the galaxy, by the time the light of the back twin got up to the first twin, that back twin would be 120,000 years old by then. So you wouldn't
wow.
even see them in the same time frame. So it's that challenge that we're working on, and it's fun because we have a rover on Mars right now stuck. It went over a rock. Poor Spirit has one wheel
stuck.
Bag.
It's stuck. I didn't know that.
It's stuck, and you can't get AAA on Mars. You have to be standing next to the vehicle. So they made up a mock-up on Mars in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to get it unstuck, so they have a model of it, and they put it on a rock under it and disabled one of the wheels and trying to figure out how they can get it off. Now, while it's sitting there, it's doing science and measuring stuff. It just can't move. So, I mean, in Wisconsin, you just rock it. But the problem is we're about 16 light minutes away from Mars, so we have to send it commands. And we don't know if we tell it to go forward, we don't get confirmation that it's gone forward for 32 minutes, 16 minutes there, 16 minutes back. So our rovers on Mars can't – we talk about this like it's sort of this remote control car of a teenager driving it around on Mars. Well, the rover has to be smart to stop, because if it doesn't, it could be seeing a cliff, and it'll take us 16 minutes to see the cliff after it sees the cliff, and then we hit the stop button, and then 16 minutes later, our stop command finally gets back to the rover. By that time, the rover has had a negative consequence with
Isn't
the cliff.
It?
So the rovers are smart. They scan around, but it's that technology we're working at, and it allows us to
now
go out.
Now, the rovers have been up there for quite a while, though, haven't they?
They were only supposed to last for 3 months,
yeah,
and they're for 5 years now.
Wow. Ooh,
if you go to the rover website, they have a little clock that says years or time after warranty. And the engineers just have fun with – because both the rovers are capable of taking pictures down at themselves. They can extend a mast and look down. They look down at themselves one day, and this dust – Mars is very dirty – was covering the solar panels. And just like, okay, if we keep getting dust on the solar panels, we're going to lose battery power, and the rovers are eventually going to die. So they're trying to calculate what they could do. And then Martian summertime hit, and the winds kicked up and just cleaned off the solar panels. So they're just like, hey, cool. So it's this little stuff that we find out that we never – you can't anticipate everything. Even with human spaceflight, they try to anticipate absolutely everything, but something will shock you. And then it comes to the ability of the engineers, the creativity. I know we like thinking of engineers as this sort of analytical group, but when you get to that level, you have to find interesting ways – with very limited things sometimes to actually solve your problem.
Yeah. Let's pause for a moment and return. We'll welcome questions from our audience, and we'll also welcome questions from our listening audience. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're broadcasting live from the History Museum at the Castle in downtown Appleton. We have a wonderful audience with us this Thursday, and we're talking about all things space this hour with Ellen Pesch, director of the Barlow Planetarium, which we had a chance to see last night and is really a jewel here in the Appleton area. So let's pause and we'll return. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And here we go. We have people in our audience here in Appleton, and good morning.
Good morning. I'm Elsie from Menasha, and I can remember when I could see the Milky Way from a Detroit suburb when I was growing up. I can't remember the last time I've seen it. But that's not why I'm at the microphone. My concern is about all that debris I hear about out in space. And I'm wondering, do the astronauts not hear that? Is there some way that the machinery is protected so it can never be damaged by that? I was listening to something last night about a fellow in New Zealand who was watching Jupiter. He's an amateur astronomer, and he realized that a comet had, that he was the first to see a comet hit. Well, you know, we may not have comets coming to us, but we do have this debris situation. Would you address that, please?
Thanks for the question. Actually, if you look at the right place, I'm going to do the first one first. I mean, from my backyard in North Appleton, partially because I know what I'm looking at, I can see the Milky Way. If you go a little bit further north, it becomes a little bit easier. But it's this night, especially in the summertime, it stretches across the sky and actually got its name from the word for milk. It actually comes from Latin and Greek for milk. It originally was called the Milky Path. And the Romans turned it into Milky Path, or the Milky Circle, then the Milky Path, which is where we got the Milky Way, not to be confused with the candy bar, okay? The debris in space, it is something that they're always concerned about. It is out there. Now, this latest impact on Jupiter, which is very exciting because we got to see Shoemaker Levy 9 hit Jupiter in 1994, which was the 25th anniversary of the moon landing. At the same time, it was really all kind of one event. This impact looks a lot like those impacts. Now, it's funny you brought up Jupiter, because those are solar system impacts, which are kind of a concern for us, because something big hit the Earth about 65 million years ago. If you go back to the early in the century, we had the Tunguska impact in Siberia, and the real concern about that, if that would happen in today's society, or worse yet, back in the 60s or in the middle of the Cold War, the people who saw Tunguska first from the West, who got to go in and see it many years after it actually occurred, said it looked exactly like Nagasaki. Ooh. And Hiroshima. It looked like an atomic bomb went off. Hundreds of square miles of trees just leveled.
Ooh.
Animals killed. I mean, it was a big impact. We think it was probably a comet or something loose-based that airburst, just like Nagasaki and Hiroshima, where the bomb blew up above the surface, and the shockwave came down and just flattened timbers. The good news is Jupiter is the biggest planet of the solar system, has a huge gravitational influence, and we think without Jupiter, Jupiter collects a lot of that stuff that we don't even see. So Jupiter is this big bodyguard for the inner solar system, and that is helping us. Now, there's another issue with space debris. It's the stuff we're sending up. If you remember, late last year, I believe, two satellites, an old Russian satellite hit a Iridium satellite phone satellite, and they hit at approximately 3 miles a second. So that's going across Wisconsin in 10 seconds or so. That's how fast they hit. That debris spread out. It was at about 500 miles up, but that debris can come down. Our space station is at 240 about. The Hubble Space Telescope is at 360. So that debris actually could cause problems as we watch it. The space shuttle can handle some impacts. It's designed. It's not fragile. The space station is also designed. There's some places that aren't as protected, but they're minor places. Like the airlocks on the space station aren't as protected from impacts as the main structure. Because, you know, if the airlock gets hit, you just shut the door. So we're watching that and doing that. It's engineered. You can see the impacts. The shields on the space station are designed to handle pretty big impacts. I know a couple years ago during the Leonid meteor shower, which is November, they expected it to storm, and they actually pushed back a shuttle mission not to have the shuttle up at that time. They thought these micrometeors, which caused the meteors, when you see these wonderful lights across the sky, they're only about the size of a grain of sand. But they're going really fast. So during that time, astronauts did not do any EVAs if anything were planned because, you know, being in the structure is better than being in a little thin spacesuit. Even though the spacesuit does have Kevlar in it for that purpose, if you have a grain of sand going at hypersonic speeds, it may not have that much of an effect. So we're worried about that. One of the things, and also to keep on this whole space thing, the whole debris thing. One of the mission objectives of the Hubble servicing mission that just came back is they put a docking adapter on the back of the Hubble when it becomes unusable. Now, 20 years ago, we just left stuff up there. Now, we will send a ship up to Hubble, latch onto it, point it down to the Pacific Ocean and fire. And that way, it'll burn up, but if anything that doesn't burn up, you know what, it's a bad day for some fish. Part of Skylab fell in Australia. NASA was actually cited for littering. But this was really? A VW-sized chunk of metal that fell in the outback of Australia. And they kind of go, ooh, how cool, you got a piece of material. What if that would have hit down in Midtown Manhattan?
Right.
In a building that had gas.
Ooh.
And traveling at a very high rate of speed. So we're watching that. Of course, we're not the only spacefaring nation right now, but NORAD watches everything in space. Anything that comes within 10 miles of the space shuttle is considered a near miss.
So what has already hit the Earth? Can you talk about meteors? Was it a meteor? Do we know where it hit that eliminated dinosaurs?
Well, that happened in Mexico, eastern Mexico, the Yucatan Peninsula, the Chicxulub crater. Actually, when I lived in Florida, we could actually see remnants of the meteor, because when the meteor hit, molten rock flew out of the crater. And as that molten rock flew out of the crater, it cools, and it cools in these really weird shapes due to the aerodynamics of the particle. And we could actually find those in Florida. And at that time, Florida was underwater. So that was 65 million years ago. We estimate that we usually get hit by something huge like that every 50 million years. So if you do the math, we're about 15 million years overdue. There's a lot of bad movies out about that, which Bad Astronomy talks about, on how do you solve this problem. There's a complete program called that tracks the asteroids, anything that crosses the Earth orbit, so we can predict if something is going to be in the neighborhood. And because with that, it's a lot like anything when you're planning something. It's nice to know way far out because you can do something small to deviate its path slightly.
Right.
As opposed to, oh, it's going to hit tomorrow.
Right.
Let's launch every rocket we have and hopefully run into it and get Ben Affleck. And he'll solve the problem, because even in that movie, everybody who studied science was always interested in finding out that it was easier to train miners how to be astronauts than it was to train astronauts how to be miners. So it's a great science. We're going to do this stuff, but we're there are people watching it, and there's nothing out there. And again, Jupiter really is good for us.
Okay. Anybody else? Come right up to the microphone if you want to talk. Yes, go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Lucy, and I wanted to give a big compliment to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a wonderful vehicle for all of us.
Thanks, Lucy. Thanks, everybody. Great.
And also to UW Fox Valley for the wonderful Barlow Planetarium, of which my husband Roy had quite a bit to do with that being. With the fundraising part of it. We just think so much of it. We have a star that we've bought, and I know that other people can do that. I think you still are selling stars.
The stars are getting pretty faint right now.
They are. So. There are other things, but it's such a wonderful resource for our community. I really commend the UW Fox Valley for all its efforts.
Yeah, it's really a lovely place. Very well taken care of, too. I thought it was brand new when we walked in last night. Yeah. And you actually, how many, would you say, 15,000 young people, students come through every year?
Last school year, we had 15,000 students visit us from mostly Green Bay is uses us a lot, Neenah, Menasha, Appleton Schools, Greenville, Hortonville. We've got some people as far west as Barneville, as far north as Mellon. So we are, it's exciting that teachers and students will make that bus trip in that yellow bus to come see us. But we have a lot of fun. Our mission is to share the wonders of the universe with whoever wants to listen to us. And sometimes we are really excited about that. And because there's so much stuff going on, and we're trying to stay up to date, even our Skywatch show called Wisconsin Skies, we change the title every month, but we designed the program so that if something happens, we can quickly change it. So even though we do the same title of the program 4 weekends in a row, it's possible for us to do 8 different shows during the month, because especially if the shuttle's up, the shuttle has landed at 3 o'clock on the afternoon and its image is in the show that night. So we're trying to keep up on what's going on. And, of course, our show this month, we talk about the moon landing and some of the things they didn't tell you and things you can look for. It's exciting because we get to see those videos that they put out, but there's these little things. I was at a tour of Kennedy Space Center, and this gentleman was there with his grandkids, and he was quiet. He was quiet the entire trip, and we saw one of the exhibits. And he comes out and he goes, "I almost died that day." And I go, "Why?" He goes, "Well, I worked for the lunar module contractor." And if you get a chance to listen to the footage, as they're talking about landing and they're going alarms and all this stuff, there's a voice that was coming from Mission Control that is doing a countdown. They don't tell you what that countdown is for. You're thinking, ooh, they know when they're going to land and all this stuff. They were running out of fuel. And as he was watching in his home in Long Island, he knew that they were running out of fuel. And when it got down to close to 10 seconds, at 10 seconds they were supposed to get out of there because you may not have enough fuel. And they touched down. He goes, literally after they land, and if you listen to the tapes, you hear Mission Control say, "You have a bunch of guys down here about to turn blue."
Right.
Because yeah. Neil Armstrong had to divert from where he was supposed to land to get away from rocks. He was running out of fuel. He was long. He knew he was long. Even Edwin Aldrin said, when Neil said in his test pilot voice, "We're long," Aldrin said, when he says something, you knew he meant it. And they had to adjust, and he adjusted and landed, and they had 5 seconds of fuel left over. But then they didn't know where they were. They weren't where they were supposed to be, so then they had to take a little bit of time to figure out where they were on the ground. So it was this great thing, and it's just fun watching the videos and especially knowing stuff later. There's an edit on the video, not to expand any ideas of conspiracy theories, but when Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon, he wanted to make sure he could get back up on the ladder. So they edit that part out of the stepping. He comes down the ladder, and if you watch the footage, he comes down off the ladder, steps on the foot pad, and then there's an edit, and then he steps off the foot pad onto the ground. They don't show you jumping back up on the ladder. He didn't want to get into that point where, great, I just walked on the moon, and now I can't get back in the vehicle.
Oh, right. You got
to
check that out.
I mean, this
is
the first time they tried to experiment with that, but it's those little stories of how they got there and the type of people they are, because they're really mm-hmm. they like to say that they're just people who got to go to the moon, and you know what they are, but they're exceptionally bright and dedicated, and for the most part the people I've met think in a different way.
Right.
They think in a
and being there made them think. A lot of them kind of lost it when they got back, didn't they? Remember that they did. Aldrin became an alcoholic, he was depressed, he was in institutions. A lot of the people were. And I could imagine. Can you imagine what it must be like going to the moon? To see
30,
the Earth from the moon?
You're 30 years old. You just walked on the moon.
Right.
Now you have another 50 years, 60 years left in your life. What are you going to do?
Right. What are you going to do? Right.
I mean,
what are you going to do?
And they have done exceptional things. I mean, so I don't. But to be in that position and to be the first person or to do this, they are very down to earth people,
right,
who were very mission based. They
yeah.
wanted to. Here's the order. You go do this.
We welcome the audience here in Appleton, and also those of you who are listening. Our phone number, I should give it to you again, is 800-486-8655. Alan Pesch is our guest, director of the Barlow Planetarium, and you can come up to the microphone here. We're going to pause for just a moment and return and take phone calls and hear from more audience members. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, we have somebody from our audience. Hello again.
Hi, Rana again. I have a question about what have we benefited from down here on Earth? I mean, I go back to my childhood. I'm retired now. So I remember Tang, and I remember reading that Tang was... Okay, remember? Okay. And the little orange covers on the plastic things and the
sure.
glass bottles, yeah. What have we benefited from? And if you can tie it in with healthcare, what things have they done for safety and for the missions and for the astronauts that have applied to us in everyday life in the last 10 years?
That is a very common question. And to answer it quickly... You almost can't get out of bed without touching something that was developed in the space program. Even your alarm clock, because I mean you need timing that is accurate. And NASA knew that when you're in orbit traveling at 5 miles a second, if you miss a point in your mission where you were supposed to fire your rockets to come back, and you miss it by a few seconds. Suddenly, you're miles off your target, and that actually happened in the Mercury program. The astronaut actually spent more time in the ocean waiting for the ships to catch up to him because he missed an important time frame. It's very important that technology, fuel pumps, the space shuttle's fuel pumps can actually empty 500,000 gallons of fuel in 8 minutes. They have to do that very efficiently. Those pumps can be miniaturized and are now used in hearts, artificial hearts, because you can pump liquid as much as you want, but if you're dealing with somebody's blood, you don't want to damage the blood as you're trying to keep them alive. And the space shuttle pumps are capable of pumping fuels without disturbing the fuels very much, which is very important if that fuel happens to be red blood cells to carry oxygen. Velcro is not a space program. That was around long before.
Oh, it's not.
No. They used it a lot, but I believe if I remember correctly, Tang was used in the space program, but it's been around long before even the first astronauts.
Huh.
So calculators, computers.
Right.
I mean, you guys, a lot of you drove today, except some of you I know biked. your car has more computing power than the lunar module that landed on the moon.
No. Isn't that
I mean,
something?
My PDA, your cell phone, has several times the total computing power that was on that mission to the moon. Now, those computers were very specific. They didn't have to play solitaire. Okay? But they had their mission, and it was stuff that had to be happened so quickly that you needed something that could calculate quickly. So there's nothing you can really do without having something with the space program that was developed in the space program and literally given to the private sector to use.
Huh. Here's an email from Jim from Green Bay. I love the science and philosophical implications of cosmic exploration, but some educated people believe that the universe is 6,000 years old, whereas our knowledge of astronomy points to the age of billions of years. If a planetarian visitor asks about the age, how do you handle the question?
First and foremost, we want to make sure we're answering our questions from a scientific standpoint. And this has been a problem all the way back to even pre-Galileo, back to Copernicus, about the literalness of the Bible, where's that 6,000 years comes in. Literally, you can go back to Egypt and you can see things 6,000 years old. The earliest pyramids are that age. You look in the sky and you can see stuff long ago, and 6,000 years, your eye is easily able to see something that is 10 times further away than that without any help from a telescope. So I've had a situation where people would ask that question, and then at some point they got to the point where they kind of go, wait a second, that means all these stars that are outside of 6,000 years, how do we see them? Then they must be much closer, and science tells us that's not the possible. So we don't want to... We have to answer from the scientific standpoint. We can appreciate the religious standpoint. But if you go back in time, Copernicus published his book about putting the sun at the center of the solar system the year of his death. He'd known it for decades, probably, because he worked for the church. He knew. I mean, church paid his mortgage. So you don't want to... Galileo got into trouble. But there's a great quote from Galileo, who knew somebody at the Vatican, and somebody at the Vatican said, this is the Vatican. He said, the Bible is a great book on how you go to heaven, not how heaven goes.
Huh. Interesting. Let's go to some phone calls. You'll need to grab some earphones here. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And let's start with Milton from Madison. Hi, Milton.
Mm-hmm. Hello. Peter Sturrock is the Emeritus Director of the Center for Space Science and Astrophysics at Stanford University. It would take several hours to describe his contributions to science. He's a real scientist. In 1973, he surveyed members of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and in 1975, members of the American Astronomical Society, about whether they had ever observed unexplained or anomalous aerial phenomena. His results were very significant. They were pretty much the same as for other trained observers and public in general. His poll of scientists also showed an overwhelming support for his continuing and increasing research into this area. In 1997, with Rockefeller funding, Dr. Sturrock convened a panel of some of the world's top scientists to study physical evidence cases. The study was published, and you should read it. You can find out more about all of this on Dr. Sturrock's Wikipedia page. Sturrock is spelled S-T-U-R-R-O-C-K. The Bad Astronomy blog, which I think you're associated with, says straight out that astronomers do not see anomalous aerial phenomena. Dr. Sturrock says that they do. I'm going to go with Dr. Sturrock, and so will 91% of the public, who favor further research. Your comments, sir?
Well, I really want to see this website. I'm interested in seeing all these perspectives. I can speak from, I didn't do any gigantic research. I do know a lot of astronomers and a lot of planetarium people. We spend an inordinate amount of time looking up at the sky. We will see things that people typically don't get to see. However, I think sometimes we do see things that we don't quite immediately understand, but we can usually find a solution to it or an explanation for it. I think we want to keep looking up. I'm not completely convinced that with the technology we have, is there stuff out there being that we're not seeing? We have a lot of air traffic control. We have a lot of people looking up at the sky. We have people who sometimes report things. And my response is a lot of times people who are reporting interesting phenomenon in the sky, UFOs, it's not so much an unidentified flying object, it's not knowing what the flying object is. And I have a great story of a lady who thought she saw a UFO that was bouncing up and down in the sky. Turned out it was Venus, but she was seeing it from a rocking chair. I think engineers, scientists are going to be watching this. I just haven't seen anything personally or with other people I've dealt with that they had a conclusion for it.
I mean, it would be fun, wouldn't it? Would it be fun if somebody came from some other place and just shook everything up? Because it would shake everything up.
Well, I think a lot of things would be rewritten. I think most scientists, they would want something like that. Just think what would happen to funding. I mean, I've been contacted by somebody, and I want to, because even when students ask me, do I believe in UFO phenomena, and I usually try to break that question down into two steps. Do I believe there's life elsewhere? And do I think it's visiting us? Well, our galaxy is one of hundreds of billions. So that's a lot of stars out there. So there has to be life out. There's not life around every star. There's not life on every planet. Is there life out there? Yes, but the life could be very, very abundant in the universe, but because of the distances, they may not be able to interact. And if something is visiting us from another star, another galaxy, or whatever, we went to the moon 40 years ago, 250,000 miles away. If somebody is visiting us or something is visiting us from light years away, their technology is so beyond ours. And I actually said this to a bunch of middle school kids. If somebody is visiting us and they look at us, what are we? And quite frankly, I think we might be a pretty interesting elementary school science fair project. I mean, it's like talking. So, they would be so advanced. And we are listening for life out there. We are listening for communications and stuff. So, and that's what we're doing, and that's the SETI project, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And if that ever happens, I mean, I think the funding will go through the roof.
Oh, it sure would.
If we got an ET signal.
We know.
Had to bring in a Spielberg movie. to do that. So
Let's go to the audience again.
Connie Roop Appleton. I'm interested, speaking of funding, your opinion on the priority to land on Mars versus other scientific endeavors that are out in space.
Well, I think when we look at this anniversary of 40 years that we've been to the moon, we were in a race against the Soviet Union to get to the moon. And it's generally believed that we didn't do it the best way possible, a way that would have kept us in space for the long term, because we haven't been back for two generations now. This step that they're working on now of doing our new launch vehicle in 2015, which is the Constellation Project with some Ares rockets, we'll be back launching people by 2015, back to the moon hopefully by 2020, and then to Mars by 2025. This is space travel. Things are going to get pushed back. But it is complicated. It is the most complicated thing we can do. When they launch that space shuttle, nothing else is as complicated as that. There's multiple things that have to go correctly. Some things, if they go incorrectly, as we saw in 1986 with Challenger, drastic things happen, or in 2003 with Columbia. So it's a very dangerous thing. It's not like buying a car. A lot of people go, well, if a car blows up, that's not a good thing for the car manufacturer. Well, space travel is not car travel. Mm-hmm. It's not even there. It's not even at Model T stage yet. Mm-hmm. So,
We only have about a minute and a half left. Give us what to look for in the night sky.
Well, Saturn is disappearing right now in the west. So if you watch the sunset, there's a bright star that doesn't twinkle as much, and that's Saturn. But what's going to be joining in our sky in the next month or so is Jupiter. And you can see Jupiter shortly after. If you stay out till about 10:30 or so, you can see Jupiter being this really bright star in the east rising. And that will be in our sky pretty much through the spring. And Jupiter is kind of cool. This is the International Year of Astronomy. And Galileo looked at Jupiter and saw moons around another planet for the first time 400 years ago. Hmm. So through telescopes, you can actually see those little moons dancing around Jupiter and get an idea of what it must have been to be the first person to see something like that and actually see them eclipse, see other things going on, see the spot. So we have a lot of good time, and that'll be it. And we'll be watching the fall as well. And we have telescopes out monthly at the Barlow, so we can have a lot of fun doing that.
Well, you were great. Thank you so much for being with us. And tell us once again, the hours at the planetarium are?
Well, we're open daily right now, except for Mondays. We go Tuesday through Sunday. We have daily shows on weekends. Our show schedule increases. We usually start our first show at around 1:30. And on the Friday and Saturday in the evenings, we have astronomy shows and rock laser shows.
And they're fun. Those are fun. And you're in Menasha, really, right?
We're in Menasha. Just south of Highway 441, you can find us on the web at www.barlowplanetarium.org, all one word. And we have our show titles and maps and everything else to get us there.
All right. Thank you. It's a great place. Thank you very much,
Thanks
Alan.
Thanks for having us.
Alan Pesch. He's a lot of fun, too, as you can tell. Director of the Barlow Planetarium. Well, that's been... We've had a good time here. I just want to remind you, our next remote broadcast will be from Frederick New Cancer Center on September 16, as we do a full 2 hours on healthcare reform in this country from all perspectives. So I invite all of you. You've been a great audience here. I just love public radio audiences. You're so smart, but you were even smarter than what I normally think of public radio audiences being, and that's really a compliment, isn't it? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this really interesting show, and we have a number of people to thank, don't we?
We do, Kathleen. Thanks to everyone at the History Museum at the Castle, Terry Bergen, Tiffany Niederferder, and from Wisconsin Public Radio, Lisa Nalbandian, Rick Ryer, Lisa Andre, Ellen Clark, Marv Nunn, Robert Schroeder, Jolema Noel, Rachel Biblow, Brittany DeAnda, Cheryl Gasser, and then Cedar Creek Catering for the food that we're about to partake in. And thanks again to our guests, George Waller, Jason Brozek, and Alan Pesch.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks everybody,
Kathleen,
for being here. Thank you. Great. We'll have news coming up in just one moment, and we do want to thank everybody in Appleton for making us feel so great. It was a lovely day. And then I'm going to be on vacation, actually. I'm going to, you know, I was asking about the stars because we're going to northern Wisconsin. We'll look at the stars in northern Minnesota where you can really see the stars. And thanks. You will have added to our trip, Ellen. That's going to be fun. So I'll be gone for a couple weeks looking at the stars. And when I return, we will do that show. I'm sorry to have missed yesterday's broadcast. It was just unforeseen. And so we will be doing a Walter Cronkite show. Okay, Rhonda?
Yes.
Thank you. When we get back, because he's worth it. You know he's worth it. There's a lot to talk about there. We have news coming up in just one moment from National Public Radio, and stay tuned for many great hours ahead here on the Ideas Network, great hours of conversation ahead. And thanks so much for listening to us. It's a minute now before 11 o'clock on this 23rd day of July. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.